far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Orbiting this at a distance of roughly 92 million miles is an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet whose ape-descended life forms are so amazingly primitive that two of them think doing a podcast called Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea is a pretty neat idea. They are Jeff and Brian. Hi there, this is Jeff. I'm with my friend Brian, and this is our St. Patrick's Day
bonus episode.
Hey Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing great, Brian. How are you?
Well, I'm puzzled.
Puzzled?
Well, let's see if we can't figure out this puzzle and put it all back together.
Yes, we're going to be doing an episode that's going to try and explain things from this book. I've always heard that this book has had a lot of inconsistencies and contradictions.
There you go.
But I never really noticed them until I read it over and over and over, making notes. And then all of a sudden, I started to notice a few things.
Yep.
And since you have been the one that has thrown out a lot of explanations in our podcasts, I thought, who better than to answer all of these questions than you?
Right. And as you've already assumed, some of them will be speculative, but some of them are actually, I think, pretty well explained in the book.
Do you think this will become canon?
Well, somebody's canon.
Yeah. Ours.
Yes,
this will
exactly.
be our personal canon.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, our bonus episodes that we've been doing have been named after the nearest holidays. So I guess this one must be our St. Patrick's Day bonus episode.
Okay, that works for me. Love it.
I decided to make it official with a little limerick.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. No, this bonus episode will not have the NSFW in front of it.
Okay, I'm ready.
So let's see if I can get this out correctly. There once was a remarkable book, so inside its pages we did look. We debated, discussed, and we swore and we cussed at some of the liberties it took.
Terrific.
Huh? How was that? How was that?
Excellent.
Huh?
Excellent.
All right.
Was that your own limerick?
Yeah, that was my own limerick.
All right. That's awesome. Better than the first poem you wrote.
Hey, that's another episode, buddy. There's no cross-posting here.
Oh, let's just call it foreshadowing.
Foreshadowing, yes.
Questionable answer one.
So I am going to start with the first thing that didn't make any sense to me when I was making my notes on the book. When Zaphod was on his way to the launching of the Heart of Gold, he had his speech with him. And in his boat, in the wind, some of the pages of Zaphod's speech flew away into the water. They were collected by an eagle who used it to build its unique papier-mâché nest. And the problem with it, they said, is that the baby eagles could not break out of the nest. I've never seen a nest that any bird has had to break out of, no matter what it was made of. So I want to know, since it's not an egg, he didn't make an egg, he made a nest. Why mm-hmm. did he make a nest that was totally enclosed? And how did the egg get in there? There's so many questions about a nest that doesn't have an opening.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's start with the quote from the book, because this one is just a slight misunderstanding, I think, of what's written in the book. Okay. So
okay.
I'll try to do my best. I have cut out some of the parts of the narrative just to make it a little shorter. But the quote says, pages 1 and 2 have been salvaged by a Damagrin frond-crested eagle. And the pages were used to create the virtually impossible nest. And it was virtually impossible for a newly hatched baby eagle to break out of it. And then later it says the Damagrin Fron Crested Eagle had heard of the notion of the survival of the species, but wanted no truck with that. Now, I'm pretty sure you're familiar with this term, but just to give you a little bit of an idea, the word truck is an anglicized version of a French word for the word barter. In other words, the French word for the word barter is troc, T-R-O-C.
Okay.
And the term in this, or the phrase in this sentence, means that he would have no trade with. Or later on it became, he will have nothing to do with. So the statement is that the eagle understood the notion of the survival of the species, but he didn't want to have anything to do with that. So he created this impossible to get out of nest because he didn't care if his eggs ever hatched and got out of the nest. That was the whole
purpose
of the
eagle. So the eagle, this rare eagle, has decided to make his species extinct.
Exactly.
Okay.
Does that make better sense?
All right.
And that one's
right in the
book.
It doesn't make any sense, but that, yes, I do remember reading all of that line. I thought of the didn't want to have any truck with it as having nothing to do with it. But I thought that was more of a joke than the reason that he decided to end his species. Because there's an easier way of just not laying any eggs. That would be a simpler version.
Right, except that it is funny to think about an eagle going through all that mental harangue just to... And his own species.
Right. Now, in propagating species is a good segue into our next question.
Questionable answer two.
It was said that Ford's father both fathered and uncled Ford. That means his mother is either his father's sister or his father's brother's wife. Is there another option, or which is it?
Well, again, the answer is what you've already stated. Yes, he could have slept with his sister, or he could have slept with his brother's wife. However, it's pretty clear that we don't understand the biology of Betelgeusean propagation. Because later on, you'll remember that Ford comes into the Heart of Gold, and the first thing he explains to Arthur is that he and Zaphod are semi-cousins, that they share three of the same mothers. So who knows how Betelgeuseans become babies?
Okay, now I do want to look this up because I was looking for that phrase in the book. And I think it's just the radio show.
Well, the part about being semi-cousins is in the book. But the part about being one of the having shared the three of the same mothers, you're right. That
yes.
May not be in the book itself.
I was looking for sharing three of the same mothers or something like that. And I could not find that.
And that's probably true. But he does mention semi-cousins. So if we... make an extension that that Adams is just not relating the additional part of the story. I don't know. It's up to you how you view that one. We clearly don't have any idea how they reproduce.
The mother thing would be difficult to explain, and I think that's why he dropped it out of the book. The semi-cousins is pretty simple because, four
semi.
I can buy semi-cousin more than I can buy shared three of the same mothers, because that implies they also have more.
Yes, and it could be, how do we know, but you also
we know that there can only be one mother. One biological mother. There are other ways to gain mothers. Well, maybe that's it. This whole commune of people,
yep,
could all be considered mothers. So it is possible.
Questionable answer three.
I've mentioned this before in passing, and we've discussed it a little bit, but we never came up with definitive answers. And that is in regards to the Babelfish, which translates people's brain waves so you can understand what they're saying by knowing kind of what they're thinking. But that doesn't explain why you are able to understand the speech of robots and computers and able to read signs like teleporter and that type of thing. So do you have reasoning for that?
Yeah, I actually do. And it does take just a tiny bit of explanation, I think. So the Babelfish, I think the book explains this the best of all the things that we've listened to. But from the book, it says, it feeds on brain wave energy received not from its carrier, but from those around it. And here's the important part. It absorbs all unconscious mental frequencies from this brainwave energy to nourish itself with. It then excretes into the mind of the carrier a telepathic matrix formed by combining the conscious thought frequencies with nerve signals picked up from speech centers of the brain, which has supplied them. So what I'm saying here, or what I'm going to say here, is the Babelfish is not listening. It's not using auditory feedback in order to understand language. It is scanning brainwave patterns and or mental frequencies. Now, it's a tiny bit of a stretch to assume that a computer can have mental frequencies, but we have heard and we listened to Marvin describe how the doors have annoyed him because they have this precognition and they have this ability to be happy with their performed services, and that annoys him. So he's picking up these frequencies, mental frequencies from the air or from the another computer. So it is a bit of a stretch to assume that the Babelfish can do this with computers, but it's not suggesting that it's creating an auditory input and output. It's absorbing all frequencies of brainwave energy and providing a bridge through the form of a matrix back into the brain of the carrier. So although it only points out in the book the function of the auditory response, where they can hear and understand and understand other languages, but it doesn't specifically say that the eyes are not affected and the other sensory items are not affected, because it does say all mental frequencies.
Right. And it does specifically say that it involves language, and language comes in spoken and written and other nonverbal type of forms. So what I got out of what you answered is that it's not picking up the brainwave patterns of the person who happens to be speaking that you're listening to. It's picking up the brainwave patterns of everybody in the vicinity.
Exactly.
And using that, it means if anybody can read it, he can read it, because he's into their brainwave matrix and it's decoding the language because he's looking at it. So, all right, I can accept that answer.
Yeah, if you think about it, I mean, I don't know about you, and maybe it's just me, but whenever I look at a sign, I'm usually singing a song about it in my head or repeating it in some sing-song fashion. So I literally interpret the sign that I visually see with an auditory mental stimulus.
Well, I don't do that, and I'm going to guess that you're in the minority.
Oh, come on. How many times have you been playing that jig game when you're driving down the road?
Exit route 42.
Yeah, see, you do it. You do it.
All right. Moving on.
All right.
Questionable answer for...
When Arthur was explaining that he met Zaphod at a party, he called it a fancy dress party. In the UK, it's what we call a costume party. So when I first read fancy dress as a kid, I thought they meant like black tie. But it does not mean black tie. It means costume party. So if
Correct.
Zaphod met Trillian at a fancy dress party. He met her at a costume party. And Ford said, it would have to be, wouldn't it? And to me, he's implying that a costume party is the only place that Zaphod would be inconspicuous on Earth with an extra head and an extra arm. So then why did Arthur say, when he was saying he's already met him, that he had the two arms and the one head at the time?
Right, and this is a really interesting question. What I have for the answer is not directly from the book. Well, there's one part of it that is directly from the book. But as you know, we're going to review some of the other parts of the story, and you know, the TV show, the movie, those kind of things. TV show dealt with Zaphod having two heads at the party by making his second head look like a papier-mâché creation. And I suppose if Zaphod is at a fancy dress or costume party, he could have done that with his second head so that it didn't look real. But I don't know why then Arthur would say he only had one head. That doesn't make sense. You're right. The movie gave us the idea that the heads were actually retractable, if you remember. Okay. But again, it doesn't say
those,
that in the book.
Those so didn't that's, exist. That's not what we're talking about. We're just dealing with the book.
Right. And in again, I know I'm going all over the place and we're trying to concentrate on the book here, but the radio show implied that Zaphod had the third arm installed after he met Trillian. The book doesn't necessarily say that. It
no,
does
it doesn't.
Say, however, he had the third arm installed to improve his ski boxing, but it doesn't really say when that particular thing happened.
I will agree.
The book only says that he visited Earth incognito. Therefore, we have to assume that he did something to hide his second head or and third arm, whatever incognito can be defined as.
And I will completely use the radio series, which came first. If he doesn't actively change what happened, it's acceptable. And so the radio series actually says he grew the third arm, and it took him 6 months to do it after he met Trillian. So he would not have had that third arm when he visited the costume party. So that's absolutely a valid answer. The head one is a little bit more difficult. And when I was thinking about it as I'm writing this question, the only thing that I came to the conclusion of is because it was two heads, Arthur just assumed one of them was fake because it was a costume party.
Right. Right.
So it could, and I mean, there's like lots of different, go ahead.
No, I agree with you. That sounds like the kind of thing that would happen to create an incognito persona.
Yeah.
Questionable answer 5.
It says in the book that Trillian said that Ford and Arthur were picked up in the same sector in which Zaphod picked her up. ZZ9 plural Z Alpha. Ford and Arthur had jumped 6 light years from Earth in the Vogon ship before they were ejected off of the ship. So how were they picked up in the same sector?
I think you and I've had conversations about this before, so you have a pretty clear idea how this is possible. But the answer is Euclidean geometry, actually. And I had a lot of fun with
moving
this.
Moving on.
Oh, no. You're going to live through this whole explanation. I promise you. Since you wrote this question, I spent some time with my wife, who you know is a mathematician. She's a school teacher and knows math really well. So as Sheldon would say, I did the math.
Okay, yes.
And first, though, I want to say that the whole idea of this sector, the ZZ9 plural Z alpha, was really just for Adams to say it was way far away from Damagrin. In fact, they say it's on the other side of the universe. Okay. So the use of ZZ was designed to imply that it was clearly they were on the AA side or the A side or the 1-0 side, actually. And the other side of the universe would be ZZ in relative terms. Okay. So,
yes.
All right. So this is how these things work out. It's interesting that even though he created this as a random set of variables, it does actually have a logic to it that can make these things work, all right? So if you think about, and I'm not going to get into the specific math here, but I'm just going to give you the overarching approach here. But okay. Because they choose a ZZ coordinate, you can understand it this way. When you add the 10 digits to the ZZ to the 26 letters of the alphabet, you get 36. Okay.
Okay.
Which 36 can then correspond to 360 degrees of a circle, 10 degrees yes. per coordinate value. Okay. So right. when you think of the galactic center of the universe as having two circles, one is
I think they're just in
plane,
this galaxy.
In a galaxy, right. Okay. Okay. Yeah, galaxy. I'm sorry. One is in the horizontal plane and one is in the vertical plane. Two circles okay. at 90 degrees from each other. Okay. Then you have the yep. beginnings of what's considered a coordinate system, right? And each number would represent 10 degrees of the circle. Then you think of the subscript, which you, when you say it out loud, ZZ9, it's a little confusing what that means, but the 9 is actually a subscript in this particular case. And when you take the 9 and think of that as you might think of the layers of an onion, where the center okay. is the lowest number and it expands out from the center in a layer, this is the layer at which the coordinate system, or I'm sorry, the coordinates of the system are. It's in the subscript of 9, okay? We don't really know because we haven't got a full factor here. But as it turns out with the galaxy, it's not as tall as it is wide. So the subscript of 9, we don't really know how thick, well, we do know when we do the math, how thick that onion layer is, all right?
Okay.
But each layer goes further out from the center. So it's the 9th layer of the globe, okay? And then the second set of ZZ further defines the sections down into, again, another 36 sections times 2. And finally, you have the alpha, which represents a division of 24 sections, all right? So when you do all the math, what you're describing there essentially is a conical or hockey puck-shaped section that's approximately 45 light years across.
Oh, okay.
So it's easy to imagine that Earth and Barnard Star, where was it? Where did they head to? I'm sorry.
Barnard Star. Yeah, that's where they were headed.
Yeah, the Earth and Barnard Star fall within that same 45-year section. Okay.
Okay.
And I thought this was really fascinating to sit down and figure out, but I was really bummed because when I figured it out, or when we figured out that it was approximately 45 years, I thought to myself, ah, man, wouldn't that have been cool if it was 42?
Yeah. Would have been. It would have been. It would have been more evidence that it is the real answer.
Oh, it's fascinating.
Like Chevy Chase said on Saturday Night Live when he was portraying Gerald Ford, I understood there was to be no math.
Oh, there was a lot of math here.
There was a lot of math.
I barely scratched the surface. Fascinating.
And I thought the answer was going to be something like, because it's a big sector.
That's great.
Questionable answer 6.
When the Heart of Gold was being manually controlled to evade the missiles, it went upside down and they all ended up on the ceiling, unable to reach the controls. So what happened to the artificial gravity that had them walking on the floors through all the other space travel and acceleration that they have done?
This is a great question, and I have to tell you that the answer to this question is kind of fun in my mind, but there is no television show or movie that I've ever seen that gets space travel correct. They all make assumptions, and because we live on Earth and we have gravity and our feet go towards the center of the Earth, they're going to assume that we're going to accept any kind of space travel that allows for or creates an artificial gravity on the ship.
Okay.
And that's what they've done here, and that's what you're kind of referring to. But as it turns out, One of the things that I really like on TV is a TV show called The Expanse. Have you seen any of them?
Yes.
Okay, so...
Yes, I...
Go ahead.
I was going to say I like that they shoot people and they don't fall down.
Exactly. I mean, they get a lot more of the space travel concepts correct, whereas other TV shows don't even bother to try to get it correct. They all wear magnetic shoes, which keeps them oriented on the floor. During their walking sequences, you can mm-hmm. always hear the click, click, click of the shoe, you know, engaging with the metal surface. You know, they have people turned at 90 degrees and walking. So that one is the closest to reality that I've seen. In fact, they also do pretty exciting things when they do scenes where they have to accelerate. They all strap themselves into a chair and then they boost their bodies with chemicals of some sort. I'm not sure what they are, but they're like pumping liquid into their veins and muscles and that kind of stuff to keep their body from crushing because of the inertia of the movement that they're involved with, especially the flipping back and forth of the spaceship.
Yes. Yeah.
But that's not really the answer here. We're not pretending like Adams is trying to make space travel real in his mind.
As long as we were talking about The Expanse for a second, I want to just mention one other thing about that show, is that when I was watching it, there is this part that's uplifting. There's just like this great big moment that they have that uses the dumbest line if it was ever taken out of context. So if you look like what was the best line of this episode and you took it out of context and you said it was just this, you'd say, oh, come on, how could you write a show where that would be the best line in the show? But if you haven't guessed which one it is, because we've not ever talked about The Expanse, really, it's when the Belter captain goes, spin the drum. Which was how they created Earth gravity in space with a rotating, because people can't heal without gravity, which was another space thing that I found to be completely wonderful about that show and the detail that they put into it.
Yeah, it really does set a new standard for space travel. But to answer your question here, what I'm going to say is that in this particular sequence, they have begun the descent onto Magrathea.
I
believe you would agree that that's what's happening here, right?
Yes.
Yep. So now they are no longer subject to the gravity or lack of gravity in space. They are subject to the gravitational pull of the planet. And in addition, they've been making random changes to their direction and velocity. So their ending up on the ceiling has to do with the direction that they're traveling in and the velocity at which they are traveling. So it's not necessarily that the artificial gravity gave out. It's that they're now in a new environment within the gravitational pull of the planet, and therefore they are being affected by their velocity and direction.
Okay.
So I don't know that the internal gravity of the ship failed, but it is pretty interesting. And if it had failed, they would have been floating around at first and then definitely thrown up against the floor or ceiling or the wall as their velocity changed in directions in response to their trying to evade the missiles.
Yes. Listening to your answer, I think what came into my head a little bit differently than the way you answered it, because I like how you go into like great detail where I do lowest common denominator answer. But because when I wanted to write the question, I wanted to make sure that I wanted to know what all the variables were. And it does. So I am absolutely sure that it says they are on their descent into Magrathea. So in my head, kind of what you said was when they go from zero gravity to being affected by planet gravity, the anti-gravity or the gravity, artificial gravity, will shut itself off because you don't need artificial gravity once you're in the gravitational field of a planet. And so if they got close enough to the planet to switch off the artificial gravity, then when they flipped upside down, they're going toward the center of the planet, whichever orientation that the ship is. So,
yep.
So that's kind of what I gleaned from your answer.
Awesome.
Questionable answer 7.
All right. Here's a tougher one, at least in my mind, because I didn't really have anything but a cheat on this. The control cabin of the Heart of Gold was described as improbability proof earlier in the book. But then when Arthur hit the infinite improbability drive button that saved them from the Magrathian missiles, it said that the inside of the control cabin was redecorated with a fetchingly redesigned interior, which means it was part of the improbability field. How was the improbability proof cabin affected by the improbability drive?
As you know, I work with computer programmers all the time. So when I thought about this particular question, it came clearly obvious to me that as they were doing the construction, the engineers could never have anticipated or did not anticipate the use of the improbability drive without the setting of coordinates. Okay. Therefore, they could not have made the cabin of the ship completely improbability proof if they hadn't considered or understood the effects of pushing the drive button without coordinates. So due to the lack of forethought, the cabin wasn't shielded for that type of activation.
Okay.
And what's interesting to me is then I will also add here, and this is little bit on the fancy side, but that may also explain why it merely redecorated itself rather than did something totally improbable, as improbable as that is.
Right.
Or if you prefer, semi-improbable. Or if you prefer and you wanted to get fancy, the engineers did anticipate this kind of activation and they programmed the cabin to redecorate itself under those circumstances.
Oh, there we go. That is one of what I would say is a cheat answer, but that will be accepted. So basically, it comes down to user error or it was programmed to do it.
Exactly. And user error seems to be the more common thought in my head, but I did think it was funny that they could have understood that and then just says, okay, let's redecorate the cabin if you do that.
I don't want to go into this here because I didn't let you prepare for it, but this was something that went through my mind when I was reading the book over and over, is in that whole scene when they're all flip upside down and everything, he could reach the button. They couldn't get to any other controls, but he could get to the improbability drive button. And I'm having great difficulties in my mind trying to figure out why this control cabin would have that button there, wherever it was. I can't even imagine where, like just on the wall, up toward the ceiling, there's a button that says improbability drive.
There you go. I don't know, but the sequence, I don't know if I can remember this exactly correctly or not, but it seems to me that the pushing of the button was early before they ended up on the ceiling, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
No, they were flipped upside down because they were doing manual controls to evade the missiles. And in all of their turns and rolls, they ended up on the ceiling. And then they couldn't use the manual controls anymore because... Okay. They couldn't reach them because they were on the ceiling and the manual controls were up above them. The only thing he could reach was the improbability drive button. And I'm just trying to figure out that whole layout in my head.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's in the center of the room in a low point or high point or something.
High point. On a big pillar. Like the ending buzzer of Ninja Warrior.
Or maybe Arthur was the only one who was strapped himself into his seat before everything started.
Oh, that could be. How'd he bruise his arm then?
Someone banged into him.
Oh, that's, yeah. Somebody who wasn't strapped in banged into him.
Questionable answers, 8 through 11.
Of all of the things that make me scratch my head, the bit that makes me scratch my head the most involves the mice. And there's a couple of different questions. But I want to state some facts out of the book of what it says, because then the questions make more sense. So the mice said that they orchestrated the trip to Magrathea. We know the plans were on display at Alpha Centauri for 50 Earth years. So it is possible that they could have known of the impending destruction of Earth. However, Frankie and Benji say that it was lucky that they left Earth for their vacation when the Earth was destroyed. So there they are implying that they had no idea that the Earth was going to be destroyed. It was just a lucky chance that they left on their vacation when it was destroyed. Third, the automated defense system shot at them, implying that their arrival was not expected. So the mice didn't call ahead to Magrathea and say, hey, we need a new Earth. We're on our way. Don't shoot at us. And then fourth, the mice left Earth with Trillian 6 months ago and arrived at Magrathea the day after the Earth was destroyed. So that is stated in the book. My first question is going to be, even if they knew of the impending destruction of Earth, and we know that they didn't, why would the mice choose to go back to the store to buy a new one instead of doing what they needed to do to stop the destruction of Earth?
Okay, so to unpack some of this, I'm going to go back a little bit. First off, that I want to say is that as to your first question about them knowing that the plans were on display at Alpha Centauri for 50 years and they could have known about the possible destruction of Earth, you've already told us, and it's already pretty clear in the book that they did not know about the destruction of the Earth prior to it happening. But the other thing that I wanted to point out is we know here that the destruction of the Earth was coordinated by a mysterious group. We don't know anything about that group in this book, okay?
Correct.
Therefore, they would have gone to some trouble. The group would have gone to some trouble to make sure that the plans for the destruction of the Earth did not come to light. They would have taken a great deal of effort to hide or at least misdirect the information so that it could not be found.
Like putting them in the cellar, in a disused lavatory, in the bottom of a locked filing cabinet, that type of...
Right, on Alpha Centauri.
On Alpha Centauri, yes.
We have to make an assumption that because these plans were clandestine, they had to be hidden. So we would not assume that Frankie or Benji or the rest of the mice could have known about it, okay?
Okay, so then you're saying that they did not know about it. So the first question is a moot question because they could not possibly have known about it.
Right. But I have an additional answer to that. So I'm going to go to the second part of your question, which was they left on vacation. At this point, the mice have been off the planet for 6 months because they had finished their particular job and left the planet early for a quick holiday.
Yes.
And while they were there, they decided to head home. I mean, when they left the Earth, that's how they got with Trillian, and they've been manipulating Trillian to get back to Magrathea. Okay, so that is what they're implying in this particular area or question. Yes. Okay, here's what I think is the interesting thing. The third question you asked was about the automated defense system. Okay,
it wasn't a question, it was a book fact.
Right, a book fact. Okay, so here's my response to that. There is no way that Benji or Frankie, the mice, could have known or even anticipated when they were going to arrive at Magrathea, because they were going along for the ride with Trillian. And as we've already defined, they were manipulating her in order to get to Magrathea. Okay?
Okay.
When Slarty says, "I think the system just takes the occasional pot shot just to relieve the monotony," that also is the answer to why the automated defense system fired at them. There was no way that Slarty or anyone on the planet could have known when the Heart of Gold was going to arrive, because it wasn't programmed. It wasn't planned for. Okay.
Right. Exactly. That's all part of my setup. That was a fact that I wanted to make clear, mm-hmm. that nobody knew they were coming.
Right. They couldn't know. They couldn't
nobody
know
knew
they...
about the, yeah.
Right.
Nobody knew about the destruction of Earth. Nobody knew that they were coming. Yes, absolutely. That's all my first 4 points were all basically to set up that nobody knew it was going to happen and nobody knew that they were coming.
All right. Yep. So here is the, I know we're going point by point here, but I think it's kind of important because it sets up a different question, which I will ask here in a few minutes. Okay. Now, for your fourth question, you said the mice left the Earth, or fourth part of
that's
that.
That's my fourth statement. Yes, statement of fact.
Fourth statement. They left the Earth six months ago and arrived at Magrathea the day after the Earth was destroyed. Okay. As Frankie and Benji are described, they are pan-dimensional beings with their projection in our universe as mice. So in our universe, they are only mice. Okay.
Yes.
They cannot influence things in this universe beyond what they can do as mice. Okay.
Yes.
Now I'm ready to answer your first question.
Okay.
Which we've already answered because we know that they did not know about the destruction of Earth. Okay.
Right. But so then we'll go on to my second question.
No. I haven't answered this first one yet.
Oh, all right.
Well, it says here, why would the mice choose to go back to the store to buy a new one instead of doing what they needed to do to stop it? Okay, we've answered most of those questions already. They didn't know about the destruction of Earth. They couldn't have stopped it, even if they wanted to, okay? And so my final part is, why would the mice choose to go back to the store and buy a new one, okay? All right, so here is what I'm thinking, or here's what I get from the story as I've read it, okay? As far as we know, the only place in our universe that these mice exist is on Earth. They could not have generated any influence on the rest of the universe due to their limited projection as mice, okay?
Okay.
So they could not have had an influence on other things happening in the universe necessarily, okay? But as to the question of why would they buy a new one? Well, when all of the mice were killed on Earth by its destruction, the people of that universe, I'm sorry, of that dimension would have known when it occurred, because they would have seen that all of these projected beings were no longer there or no longer existed.
Right.
So they knew of the destruction of Earth. And that is when they ordered Earth Mark II.
Yes.
So what's your second question? Yes.
The question is, since the mice just arrived and arrived unexpectedly, how was the Earth Mark II already halfway completed, since they could have only known about the destruction of the Earth one day ago?
Right. And I love this question.
So anyway, I also have, when did they start building it? Why did they start building it? And also, we'll throw in there, the program was to run for 10 million years, but the Earth is thought to be 4.5 billion years old. So why is there that discrepancy?
You're going to love this answer.
I will.
Okay. So here it goes. You ready?
I'm ready.
It takes the Magratheans 6 days to create a planet.
And then they rest?
Yes, you got it. 7 days and a planet is done. And you know that he even talks about the fact that, oh, we haven't even planted the fake dinosaur bones yet.
Yeah, he did talk about that.
So as far as the human beings who were on the planet, how could they possibly know about the how old the planet in fact was? There's still, I mean, I'm not saying there is any debate about how old it is, but the fact is that my answer is they build planets in 7 days. Actually, six days. Rest on the seventh.
Yeah. They build planets in 6 days. I like that answer. Still, he does say half done, so maybe they, you know, they're putting in some overtime.
Well, half, you know, if they're the builders, they're always going to overproject and underdeliver.
That's true. The Scotty principle.
So they literally had 1 day to start working on the planet, and he does describe the. I mean, Slarty defines the planet as coming to life. So it's just right. getting started in the process. And it's only had right. one Earth day to start building its planet.
Okay.
Questionable answer 12.
And then the last question that I have is that when the mice were leaving, they decided that they needed to manufacture a question that sounds good. They have been on the chat show circuit debating the question for 10 million years. So why have they only now started to think of what the possible answers could be? And in all of those possibilities, there has to be one that rises to the top as the most. And so, you know, why haven't they been able to come up with an answer by now that sounds good?
Right. So again, this is a great question, but I also, there's a couple of assumed facts that we don't know. Clearly, Benji and Frankie are the latest generation of their beings to be on the planet and working with Earth to control its destiny. We have no idea what the lifespan of these individuals are. I mean, we can assume they have a similar lifespan to us, you know, 100 years or whatever. They're in the millionth generation after the creation of Earth. We really don't have any idea how long these two individuals, Benji and Frankie, have been debating an answer. I mean, they started at some point in their adulthood and they've continued till now. And they do say in the book, they were just recently contacted by the 3D chat shows and they want us to come on and talk about the answer. So They haven't really thought in their mind that they weren't going to get an answer because they didn't know the planet was going to be destroyed. So until the destruction of the Earth, they could not have been creating an answer. They may have been speculating on what one might be.
Well, yeah, that's what I figured they've had to have been.
Right. But if they chose one of their pre-discussed speculated answers, I think they would think of themselves as too self-serving and their audience would not think of it as genuine.
Oh, so they've already discussed on some chat shows possible answers. So all of those they can't use.
Correct.
Because they've already divulged those as speculation.
Yep.
And they can't be right. Because then What would be the point of building the computers if they could just figure it out themselves?
Right, exactly.
Questionable answer 13.
But now I have a question.
Oh,
and I didn't prepare you for it, so I'm sure you're
No, you didn't.
I'm sure you're going to wonder what this one is. So it all starts at the beginning of your question about mice. Okay.
Okay.
So we know the story from Slarty and the discussion between Magic Thighs and Broomfondle about the creation of Deep Thought and then the secondary creation of the Earth. Okay.
Yes.
Deep Thought was a computer created by these pan-dimensional beings.
Yes.
And we've seen in their projecto screens and on their cellotape, whatever it was, those interactions with Deep Thought.
Correct.
So my question is, why on Earth, that was supposed to be a joke, did they create the Earth in a dimension that was not their own? That doesn't make any sense to me.
The only answer that comes off the tip of my brain, or tip of my brain, The first thought that comes to me about that question is that they did not want to have any undue influence over it at all. So by projecting themselves as mice, and the only influence they could have over the program was that of a mouse, there is no way that they could mess up the program by checking on it or influencing it if it was in a dimension where they couldn't do anything.
Right, exactly. You know, and I think that's a brilliant answer. I mean, that's got to be the answer, but it just seems so odd to me to go to all this trouble and struggle to and make that in another dimension where obviously they get hosed in the end because the planet gets destroyed by the folks that live within that dimension.
If you lived in a dimension and you had this computer that was going to produce the most important information ever in the history of information of your dimension, you know people would mess with it from your dimension. If they could find a way to influence it to make it better for them, it would be influenced. So by sticking it in a dimension that was inaccessible, then nobody could mess with it for selfish reasons.
Right. And that answer in itself is one of the reasons why I feel pretty confident about the mice being just a small cog in the wheel here. They had no control over the destruction or any of the other parts of the Earth events that take place, you know, other than what they could control in their laboratories. So their influence in our dimension was tiny and only affected the Earth.
Right. Also, when Slarty was talking about how the mice were controlling people with, you know, what did we say? Running down the maze the wrong way, eating the wrong bit of cheese, suddenly dropping dead from myxomatosis or something like that.
Yes, yes, exactly.
When I first thought about it, I was like, well, why would these mice kill themselves? But remembering that they are only projections into the universe, and the ending of the mice in the lab is not the ending of a being, it's just the projection from the other dimension, it makes it more palatable.
It does. And that's another point that kind of wrangles me just a tiny bit about this, is that it does say in the book that Benji and Frankie needed to get back to Magrathea in order to return to their dimension. So
yes,
that part kind of makes me wonder too, because if they are just projections and they can turn themselves off in our dimension and just return to their own, then that doesn't correspond quite as nicely as other ways. Yeah.
All right. So how did you enjoy looking up all of these answers or creating all of these answers?
Yes, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really fun to look at the data that we had within the book. I have to admit that it's difficult to separate the different stories from the different sources and stick only to the book here to get an answer. It was fascinating to look back.
Yeah, there are things that he clarifies and there are things that he will say corrects as things go on when he realizes, oh, this was a dead end. I gotta not do this. I need to change it because then we can go on. When we're answering these questions, it has to be just from this book, or I hope we'll do this for every book. So for every book in the series, I hope to do this segment immediately after the release of that discussion on the book. And for answers for all of the other books, you can obviously refer to the previous book, unless there is something in that book that directly contradicts what happened in the first book.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, Jeff, say goodbye to the great folks out there.
Goodbye, great folks out there. Hi, this is Jeff. I hope you had fun listening to us discuss some of the parts of the book we found confusing and merited further explanation. There may be some of you out there who have your own questions about things in the book that you would like answered that we did not cover. If you do, email the questions to digitalwatchespodcast@gmail.com. If your questions are about a book we have already covered, we will try to work the answers into the beginning of a future episode. If the questions are about a book we have yet to cover, we will try to work those answers into that book's episode. Thank you for listening to Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea. Look for us the first Thursday of every month for a full episode. We will also release a bonus episode later in the month. A very special thanks goes out to Luke, Max, Greg, and Tim Lesnick for arranging and performing our opening theme. We would also like to thank our talented friends and families for their voice work on our introductions and commercials. A very special thank you goes out this episode to Kelly Lesnick for counting up our questions. Visit our website at digitalwatchesareaprettyneatidea.buzzsprout.com, where you can find links to all my Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy-inspired t-shirt designs. You can find us on Facebook and YouTube as Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea, and on Twitter at Watches Idea. If you'd like to contact us, our email is digitalwatchespodcast@gmail.com.
This has been a Fruits for Thought production.